This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. Last week, best-selling author Pat Conroy died at the age of 70. He spent his life writing about his father, Colonel Donald Conroy, who was immortalized in the 1979 film The Great Santini, based on Conroy's novel, drawn much from his life. When Pat Conroy joined us in 2013, he had just published the latest book about his childhood, this one called The Death of Santini, a story of a father and his son. Let's take a listen. Is this book a kind of a last rite for you and your relationship with your father?
I certainly hope so. You know, I've been writing about this family for 40 years. I think it's the only subject I've ever written about. It is time for me to move on to something else. And since I live in the age of vampires and zombies and interstellar space, and there are many subjects I have not yet dealt with, but I think I was born into an alien family, and that's what I have been writing about. So there's some correlation here, too.
So the idea of perhaps using zombies as a kind of fill-in for the for your father or the rest of your family. But do you really feel like with this book that you're not done with your life, because you're never done with your life, but done with sort of writing about your family and all
I certainly hope so. You know, there's certain stories that, in fact, my family has been – my Chicago Irish family wants me to write a story about the Chicago Irish, but I know nothing about them. There are different parts of my Southern family that think I denigrated the Southern branch. They would like me to do that. But for me, it was always the personal psychodrama that took place within my own family, my mother and father, the seven kids. Right. They produced six miscarriages, and I thought, you know, the miscarriages were the luckiest people on earth. I mean, and my sister always thought they heard what was going on and just said, no way, man, I'm not going into that. But it was a difficult childhood. To me now, it looks like a criminal childhood. Mm.
Well, and as a reader, it feels almost like living under, as you write about it, a kind of a terrorist regime.
There are no surprises in life for me when I meet the latest Ayatollah, when I meet a czar, when I meet a dictator, when I meet, you know, someone who is genocidal, somebody who is, you know, absolutely hateful in running a country. It just reminds me of the way Dad ran a family.
Well, as I said, and you write in your book that you said, I hated my father long before I knew there was a word for hate. You were a little boy.
I
hated didn't have
that.
Language, but you had hate.
I hated him when I was in diapers, and I hated him when I was being fed while Mom was, you know, spooning in whatever baby food she was. And my first memory, they had a thing by PEN America, had a thing a couple of years ago about your first memory. And I didn't write mine because I wasn't ready then to tell. But my first memory was of my father beating my mother to the floor with a backhand and her trying to stab him with a butcher knife. And this to me was, hey, Pat, welcome to the world.
It must be such a burden to feel that you hated your father. I mean, a burden for the child to carry that kind of hate. And I have to say, without giving too much of the book away, I mean, I don't know if reconciliation is too strong a word, but you certainly, after The Great Santini was published, your father became your defender because the family was very angry at you for exposing all these secrets and I guess telling tales. And your dad was there to defend you to some degree.
Yeah, you know, the biggest surprise of my life was when The Great Santini was published. Dad evidently threw the book across the room, stomped it, disappeared for days. His whole family would call me, say he's killed himself. Nice going, Pat. You killed your father. And, of course, I felt horrible. But Dad hears his family is jumping on me, so he comes back and writes him a letter saying that his son wrote this book. He'd read it. He said he loved the description of the mother, the children, the Marine Corps, but his son did not have enough talent. His son did not have enough greatness. His son did not have enough vision to write about the great Santini himself. Mm. and that was the only failure in the book. So he then started signing books with me for the rest of his life, wherever I went.
Were you surprised that he, after that book and all the reaction to the book, we're almost up on a break here, but that he sort of embraced this portrait that you painted of him?
He embraced it in such a way you would not have. Dad died thinking he was responsible for Robert Duvall's career. Before he played me, son, he had no roles with any meat on it, any masculinity on it. And I said, Dad, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, yeah, he did okay. He said, but he couldn't carry a movie until he played the great Santini. I made that man. And I said, Dad, it's your modesty that Hollywood looks for most of all. But, you know, he thought it was stupid killing Santini at the end. And I said, why? And he said, it messed up the sequel.
But do you think your father turned you into a writer, and your father's abusive behavior made you a writer?
Yeah, it made me one. And I think it turned my sister into a poet in New York. And I think coupled with my mother's extraordinary love of reading, her love of books, her love of story, to mix in this incredibly violent family, and especially the family that holds secrets. You know, that is always the volatile family. And I think it's always the normal one. It's always the one you're not supposed to tell. And every family knows what they're not supposed to tell.
Right.
And you can be living a life right now, and there's stories you know should not come up anytime, anywhere, and they almost never do.
I also got the feeling in reading this book that there were moments in your life where you felt you were rather like your dad. And part of it with a temper, you talk about your brother, Tom, who committed suicide, but having to deal with him and feeling the kind of rage and frustration and anger at him that for whatever reason, it seems your father felt towards his family.
You know, the brothers in the family, we have a game we play. It is a horrible game. It's called MLD, Most Like Dad. Mm. And we'll sit around at Thanksgiving or Christmas, and we'll just be talking, and somebody will say something, and there'll be a gesture or a motion or a look or a tone. And one of the brothers says, they'll point at the offender and say, MLD, MLD. And we all know we're like him in various degrees, and it kills us. My one poor brother, Jim Conroy, who we call the Dark One, always wins.
Really?
Hands down. And he knows it. It drives him crazy. But he knows that he is most like Dad, and Dad's spirit lives most strongly in Jim, more than all of us. Thank the Lord. Mm.
But as you said, there were times in your life where you felt like you were, you know, a slightly softer version of your father.
But truth is, deep down, Marty, I am the same guy. I was raised in a household where I saw mother abuse that almost always ends up. That kid almost always ends up an abuser. I was raised up as a kid where all the kids were beaten. I saw every single one of them beaten at different times. That kid grows up with that image impressed on his consciousness. It does not die. It lives forever. It's a constant struggle, a constant battle for me every day of my life not to be like him. If I ever hit a wife, I'm going to kill myself. Mm. I don't want to hit my kids. I just don't want to be that guy. Yet I can feel Dad living in my bloodstream, coming out in my anger, my fury. And sometimes I put that anger in my books.
You said when you wrote The Great Santini that you came across, or I guess after that book was published, you came across this word dysfunctional, that you were a dysfunctional family. But I was thinking about the word. It's so graphic. It doesn't really explain anything about a family.
It doesn't to me. You know, dysfunctional sounds kind of sweet. You know,
it doesn't like, work, right?
You know, plumbing is off. You know, and you know what I was seeing. You know, when you see your mother bleed from someone hitting, when your mother ends up stabbing your father during a family argument, you see blood. Your dad going up, dripping blood, and her getting the children out of the house and going racing off and just being beaten up so many times yourself. that I think I remember them all, but I don't. You know, sometimes I'll wake up just in the middle of the night and just remember another one. I said, I'd forgotten that. Yeah. And I think it affects every aspect of your life coming from a family. And it can be the mother. It doesn't have to be the dad. It can be anybody in that family. And sexual abuse puts another whole new dimension to it, that thank the Lord that did not happen to me. But it is all one thing. Dysfunctional, doesn't quite do it, is a word for me.
Is there a better word?
Not that I can think of. I want to say supersonic. I want to say, of nuclear disaster. But I know growing up in a family like that, there's this inferno kind of feeling that you cannot escape, you cannot get out, you cannot do anything.
You're right. I don't believe in happy families. A family is too frail a vessel to contain the risks of all the warring impulses expressed when such a group meets on common ground. I underlined that.
Yeah, it's. I have a lot of people fight me about, the families. I had a story. I've always loved people that came up to me in signings, and they'll say, "Boy, your family's nuts, aren't they?" And I'll say, "Yeah, they are." And I said, "How about your family, pal?" And this was one particularly good-looking couple. And the guy said, and he looked like he's going to be governor of South Carolina someday. He's one of those guys.
I think I know what you're talking about. But yeah, go ahead.
And he said, I said, "Let's be honest. Let's go through your family. How far do we have to go to hit the first crazy? Dad, mom, brother, sister, and uncle." And I don't know anything about you, Marty, but, generally that kind of covers it. I can, with that group, I can hit something. I can hit a mother load with that group. This guy says, "My family's perfect." And I said, no. Finally, his wife can't stand it, and she finally breaks, and she says, "His mother's nuts. His mother's nuts. She's crazy." And I said, this is, to me, normality. In a family, a good family is one that, can embrace that, can embrace craziness, can, move that in, soften it when it comes up, deal with it, and we all have to deal with it.
Right.
It's just part of, and it's one of those outer moons of love that none of us quite know what to deal with, but we have to learn to deal with it in some way.
But it's interesting that people have appropriated the great Santini. I mean, that's when someone says that, "My dad was the great Santini," we know what that means.
It's unbelievable.
That was my 2013 interview with Pat Conroy, author of The Great Santini, who died last week. He was 70 years old. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my interview with actor and activist Maria Bello. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Outside of her work as an actor, Philadelphia native Maria Bello has spent her time advocating for a variety of public causes. She answered phones at a domestic abuse hotline while attending Villanova University, and she was active in recovery efforts in Haiti following the 2010 earthquake. Lately, she made waves with her book, Whatever, Love is Love, Questioning the Labels We Give Ourselves, Dismantling Long-Held Ideas About Relationships and Identity. She joined me in 2013 when she was in town to accept an award from the Women's Law Project. We discussed her life, her activism, and her more famous roles, from The History of Violence to The Cooler. Let's listen. Looking at something in Huffington Post where you asked about Oprah Winfrey and her influence on you, and you said, "As a child, so much was going on in my near and extended family, a lot of stuff that I could not comprehend, and no one ever spoke about alcoholism and drug addiction, mental illness, abuse, and then suddenly there was this beautiful woman, Oprah, on TV."
Yeah, that's exactly
that was,
right.
That was true for you as well?
Oh, it was completely true for me.
But the idea is, and I don't think your family is unusual. I don't know much about it, but I think most families have some degree of these problems.
I do too. And I think it's especially with this younger generation, kids are more apt to talk about it now. It's okay. It's not these dirty little secrets all the time. And thank God for that.
But were you a kid that noticed things but just felt like you couldn't talk about it or you didn't know how to talk about it or it just wasn't a subject that could be talked about?
For sure, but I feel like that's made me who I am, and part of my activism and speaking out is because of all of the experiences I had in my life and everything that I went through. But certainly as a kid, you see everything as a kid, and you don't understand. And, you know, that's why with my own son, I have a 12-year-old son, I try to talk with him about all of it, you know, talk about it as much as I can. Yesterday's talk was funny because I know Larry Flint, and I was with him and his wife the other night, and I was trying to explain to Jackson who Larry Flint was, and he was like, "Mom, I think I'm a little too young to talk about this right now." Because I said, "Oh, do your friends, do you talk about pornography yet?" He was like, "Mom, really?" So some things maybe not talk about.
Fair enough. You grew up in Norristown.
I did.
That's where your family is from.
Uh-huh.
You went to Catholic school.
I did. Good Catholic school girl.
A good Catholic. And were you a good Catholic school girl?
I went to Archbishop Carroll and then to Villanova University. Yeah. I was good in my own way, but, you know, in my own way, a bit of a revolutionary. I found, it was my birthday last month, and I found all these journals and letters from when I was a kid, from when I was 15 years old. And one of them was to an old boyfriend, and it said, you know, "You have to respect my opinion. If I feel like speaking out at the against sexism in the Catholic Church, I should be able to do that." And I'm like 18 years old, so definitely.
Yeah. I also read you were a varsity cheerleader. Is that true?
I was for 2 years. For Carroll, for football.
For football.
And my brother was a football player.
Wow. So you can do that jump, that thing where you jump and...
Yeah, there's only one cheer I remember.
What was that?
It goes, "First and 10, do it again, touchdown, touchdown." I do it sometimes.
And you went on to Villanova with the idea of going to law school and being, as you said, this advocate for women.
That's right. And I was editing a book for my mentor, my professor, Father Ray Jackson, who's my son's namesake. Yep. And I was devastated when I started taking this acting class because I realized that's what I was supposed to do. And I went to Father and said, "I don't know what to do. I feel like I'm supposed to be in service of the world, and this is such a selfish profession." And he said, "Maria, you serve best by doing the thing you love most." And that has always, always stuck with me. And if I could tell kids anything, I tell them that. How about that? Just that.
And why was he your mentor, Father Ray Jackson?
A friend, when I was going through my stuff, saw a picture of him the other day. She said, "He looks so fun." Number one, I said, he was fun. He had a sense of humor. I don't really get a kick out of earnest people. I don't really get a kick out of people who think that they know it all and they're very serious about their particular issue. I get bored. I like people who are – he was such a compassionate man, such a brilliant man. Understood all aspects of liberation theology, sexism, racism, whatever it was in the world, and still had such a life and a sense of humor about it, and compassion and connection.
Where is he today?
Oh, he passed away, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, but you named his son after. Your son after him.
Yes. Jackson Blue, my son's name is.
And did Father Ray Jackson know that you did that?
No, but I know he knows because I know he's right on my shoulder every single day. Every single day I'm doing this work, I know he's here on my shoulder. I have a picture of him from the pulpit winking. And I look at that picture and I go, "Okay, I'm not alone. Thank you."
So I guess you took an acting class. Was it at Villanova?
It was at Villanova. It was mostly because I had a crush on this boy who was taking the class, and someone said I could take it as an elective. But, you know, I grew up in a family. We didn't know you could be an actor for a living. Really had no idea. And I did. I took this class, and I just knew in that moment.
Really?
That's what I was supposed to do. So instead of going to law school, I went to New York City with two trash bags filled with clothes and $300 and arrived there on New Year's Day. And I read that journal the other day, too, my first day arriving there. Terrified but excited. I knew something was going to happen.
And again, I mean, there's a theme here. You land in Haiti, you know you're supposed to be there. You try an acting class, you know you're supposed to be an actor.
Well, my mom has always taught us that about signs, you know, that there's a higher power looking out for us, leading the way. And if we only keep our eyes open and look for those signs, we'll be led on the right path.
So what was it? I mean, was it just this being somebody else? The experience of acting, of just sort of taking yourself out of yourself?
I don't think it was taking myself out of myself. Since I was a little kid, I think I started reading novels, my mom said, by the time I was 6 or 7.
Really?
And I was reading romance novels by the time I was 9 and 10, because I wanted to be like the girl on the pirate ship dressed like a guy, and then the captain falls in love with her. I love these action adventures. And I always would put myself as the character in the book and see myself as that. So I had such a big fantasy life. So when I got the opportunity to read the words of other people and be different characters, mm-hmm. and yet to use all of my emotions and everything that I had experienced, but use their words, it was so freeing for me.
And did your teacher know? I mean, did someone say, did people say to you, Maria?
Again, another sign, the wonderful teacher that I had at the time, my first acting teacher, Helene White, actually called my parents to say, your daughter has a real gift at this.
Wow. And you had never done that before? You hadn't been in a high school play?
No.
Or, really?
We always put on plays when I was a kid. I was always Mary with Joseph and Mary story on Christmas. We were always putting on shows for our aunts and uncles when we all got together. But, you know, that was the thing back then, too. In my grade school, like you said, I was a cheerleader. In my grade school, we didn't have soccer back then. You know, girls didn't play soccer. And when my dad taught soccer, coached my brother's soccer team, he let me come practice for a couple days because he said, why can't she be on? And he got crap for that.
Really?
Yeah, because that was back then. But the same with, you know, funding of arts education. That's still the same. So here we are in a Catholic school. We didn't have plays, right? So just not something that I did.
So there you are with your two garbage bags arriving in New York. Big plans, big ideas. And how much time did you spend bartending or waiting or waitressing?
For about 7 years.
Really?
I moved from floor to floor and couch to couch and basement to basement. Went to school for about 5 years and did off-Broadway plays and opened a theater with my friends. And even though then I knew, I was so damn poor at one point, homeless, and my mom had to bring me up medicine when I was sick from Philadelphia. I knew it was romantic. I knew I would look back and say, this was such a romantic time in my life. I really, really enjoyed it.
And was there, obviously something happened. Either you got a role or I read that you were in an Amstel Light commercial.
I was in an Amstel Light commercial. I walked up to a table and I went, Amstel Light, right? So I had a couple of commercials during that time. I did some wonderful plays, and then I went to Los Angeles to visit somebody I was dating when I was 27, I think, or 28. And the first day I got there, I met a casting director from Philadelphia. She said, read this for me, and I said, okay. I read it, and I got the job.
Wow. And what was the job?
It was a pilot for a show called 77 Sunset Strip, the remake of it.
Huh.
And a pilot means you just do one show, right? And so I did one show, and then I'm so happy and very lucky to say I never stopped working since then.
Really? And is that because people, and I have to say, looking over your career, you've had such a diversity of parts. You seem to be open to different kinds of roles.
I think that's right. I think people understood very early on that they couldn't just cast me as sort of the hot chick on the side. I just don't have the personality for it. I also think that I've never tried to look younger or not my age. So even when I started working, at 30, that was kind of like old to be this. So I've never been an ingenue, so that wasn't the point. For me, it was about taking roles that were challenging and that were really fully fleshed out women, like all the women that I know in my life. So I felt very fortunate in that.
And it seems like you're still getting roles. You've got movies, one in July, Grown Ups 2. You've got in September, Prisoners. And then you've got a movie, Third Person. So I'm not sure how old you are, but it doesn't seem to have held you back.
Listen, I always say, I think a lot of the reasons women in Hollywood complain that there's no roles for women over 40 is because they're trying to look 20. How about that? Don't try to look 20, because those roles are going to go to a 20-year-old. How about just look your age?
Yeah.
So I feel fortunate that I've gotten some great, great roles this year.
I read about a director saying about you, it's 20 minutes of hair and makeup and then she's on the set.
Yeah.
The idea is that you don't need to glam up for the cameras?
Yeah, no. And mostly that's not for any other reason other than it's hard for me to sit in one place for a long time. I'm like,
oh my God, chasing you around with a brush?
Yeah, totally. And my grandmother, when I first became an actress, she said somebody was interviewing her, one of my first TV shows, and they said, did you ever think that your granddaughter would be an actor? And she goes, my granddaughter never even brushed her hair. No.
But do you, when you look at yourself, I mean, are you harsh or are you judgmental? I mean, women sometimes are so tough on themselves, and you live such a, you know, a public life.
I think we all are to a certain extent. But even guys I know now, right, who are getting older, not even getting older.
We just picked one scene from The Cooler. The Cooler is this really, really wonderful story, and it's you and William H. Macy. You play this cocktail waitress, Natalie Belisario. He's this cooler, this sort of sad sack, bad luck guy, a guy named Bernie Lutz. And let me just play this scene, and then we'll talk about it. And in this scene, our guest, Maria Bello, is playing Natalie Belisario, a cocktail waitress at a Las Vegas casino, meets this guy named Bernie Lutz, played by William H. Macy. And in this scene, Natalie and Bernie are at a diner, and she's reviewing his astrological chart, explaining he's a slow starter when it comes to romance. Let's listen.
But I can tell by the look on your face that you think this is all a lot of BS.
No, I know what the outcome's gonna be.
There's not like one particular outcome. A lot of things come into the picture, like the planets, the moon.
The outcome won't change with me. It'll be all bad.
Oh my God. I have never met anyone who was so down on themselves.
Do you know what I do at the Shangri-La?
I asked around. You're a cooler. You turn winners into losers.
Do you know how I do that?
Listen, I know there's a lot of stuff that happens in casinos all the time.
I do it by being myself. People get next to me, their luck turns. It's always been that way.
Well, that sounds like a self-fulfilling prophecy to me. There's a whole chapter of that in my book.
I only got 6 more days. Well, really, almost 5. I'm leaving town.
Only 5 more days? Then we shouldn't waste any more time.
A scene from The Cooler. I really like that scene. I think it works as audio, but it's really fun to see the two of you together. There's such sort of sweetness and innocence, and she's seducing him, but in such a gentle, nice way.
Yeah. As soon as I read that script, I read her voice. That voice came out of me, and it was very Philadelphia accent, by the way.
I heard a little bit of that, yeah.
And that was exactly how her voice came out, and I went into audition for it, and it was one of those things, too. I knew I was supposed to do that. And it was a year after I had my son. I thought I'd never work again, right? Because, you know, I'm a new mom, and oh, am I going to work? My career's on hold. And I got that, and who knew that it would be this brilliant, beautiful, beautiful little film. But more than that, it was the experience itself that really put me on a whole new track in my career and who I am as a human being.
And it was directed by Wayne Kramer. And I have to say, there's a scene where you and William H. Macy, Bernie Lutz, are making love. And it's really a beautiful scene. And you can see your bodies. You can see the intimacy between these two characters as they're exploring each other. And it's such a lovely moment. And you're naked.
Even then, we had to go to the ratings board to try to get an R because I was naked. And that always made me so insane that you could put so much violence on. And these scenes, which were, they weren't, you know, graphic violent scenes against the women. These were important scenes in a movie. So I was proud of that, and I was proud of that I, you know, we both have had at that time, you know, kind of regular bodies, and there was no issue about it.
Are there certain things that you look for from a director? I mean, I realize every director is going to be different, but as an actor, something that you need from a director?
Yes. I work with directors who are like good fathers. By good fathers, I mean that they have really strong boundaries and let you play within those boundaries. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I was with my friend Oliver Stone the other day, who I did a great movie with called World Trade Center. And he's been one of my favorite directors to work with. Him and Cronenberg, Sean Q, Haggis, they're all very similar directors in that they respect everything that you're bringing. They know that your job as an actor, they don't hardly have to give you notes because they respect that you're going to make it better. They just trust their actor. And at the same time, in the context of the story, they'll help you to know and remember exactly where you are and what needs to happen. Hmm. You know, so you're sort of on the right track.
Do you do a lot of homework for when you're going to play a role?
Never.
Never. You just sort of draw on those instincts, those feelings?
I do, and a lot of people, you know, and I was taught that as well, you know, write the history of the character, write the... It never helped me, you know, and it helps a lot of people. For me, I feel like I have a million different experiences in me, a million different pieces of me, and for particular parts, I pull up some of those pieces, mm-hmm. and I use that with the words and with the experience and listening.
And when you mentioned looking for roles, I mean, it seems like you are attracted to these intense characters. I mean, and I guess because you really get to act, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one of our gifts as actors that we get to give to the world is we get to feel things so deeply, have experiences so deeply that other people don't have to go there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like that most people would never get in that circumstance, that ease in, for instance, to have that sort of rage, but people do have it underneath somewhere, just can't be expressed. So to have someone else express it for you is like, okay, I'm okay.
That was my 2013 interview with actor and activist Maria Bello. Her new movie, The Confirmation, will be playing at the Bryn Mawr Film Institute. This is part of the New York Film Critics series. And when we get back from the break, we'll hear about how a family used Disney films to communicate with a son with autism. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks again for tuning in today. When Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind found out that his son Owen had autism, his world was forever changed. But when he noticed Owen's fixation on animated Disney films, he and his son began using characters and storylines to communicate with each other and the rest of the family. Suskind wrote about this amazing breakthrough in his book Life Animated, A Story of Sidekicks, Heroes, and Autism. It was recently turned into a documentary and took home a Sundance Award for Best Directing for a documentary. Let's take a listen. What was Owen like before autism?
He was a pretty chatty 2.5-year-old. You know, I love you guys. Let's get ice cream. Where are my Ninja Turtles? All the things 2.5-year-olds are concerned about. And we didn't see anything. Now, looking back with regressive autism, it's about a third to a quarter of all the kids who are on the autism spectrum, which is now one out of every 42 boys in the United States, which is rather astonishing.
Hello.
This is back in 1993, though, before everyone knew about autism. I mean, mostly what we knew then was Rain Man. That's what most folks know. They saw the movie. And it felt like vanishing, Marty, but of course he's still there. It's not as though he actually disappears. It's just he regresses and he loses function. So from that full 2.5-year-old vocabulary of, you know, 200-300 words, he ends up after a few months down to one word. Juice was his only word, was juice.
And it seemed that even his body movements were changed as a result of this regressive autism.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact is that autism is a pervasive developmental disorder, so it strikes everything. It's pervasive, as they say. So his motor control is off. He's walking around like someone walking with their eyes closed. He's not sleeping, which is something that is startling to a family. You know, we have two boys, and they both were traditional babies. You know, they're up for a while, then they learn how to sleep, and that he seemed to have lost that too. So we were concerned in ways that just left us mostly terrified and confused. I said, a kid doesn't grow backwards. What could this be? Until Cornelia, my wife, and I finally talked to the first person who said autism.
And what did that mean to you back in 1993?
Well, it meant Rain Man. It was plain and simple. We said this. We basically said our child cannot be Raymond Babbitt, the Dustin Hoffman character. That's just not possible. And it's interesting because you sit down and you hear this word, and you can almost feel your life changing in those seconds. I can see those two people sitting in the doctor's office, my wife and I now, because even at the moment, it was like you float out of your body and you're looking down on them, frozen in their chairs. And then a whole new life begins for the whole family. You know, Owen is the one who's whacked, but we all start our change. And the book is largely about not just Owen, but how all of us changed.
And what Owen begins to do is just obsessively watch Disney movies. As you watched him watch, what did you see? What did you observe?
Well, we saw that he was uncomfortable almost everywhere except there. Up in the bedroom in our house in Georgetown, we were renting a house, he seemed settled and at ease. We asked our doctors about it. We had a team of specialists already. And they said, look, is he joyful? We said, he seems to be. Mm-hmm. Is he seem comfortable? Yes, yes. So don't cut it off. Well, we said, well, all he wants to do when he's not densely scheduled by Cornelia, by my wife, running to every therapist we could find, every doctor, is he likes to watch these movies. And they were the movies he liked, Marty, before the onset of the autism. Every kid loves these movies of this period. I mean, remember, Disney had a couple tough decades and then roars back in 1989 with a movie called The Little Mermaid that was a huge hit. And then Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. These were some of the biggest movies of any movies in those years, and every kid watched them. The difference, though, is after the autism, Owen seemed intently focused, and he would rewind them often and just would stay up there for hours.
And you have this extraordinary event where his older brother Walt is having his birthday, and his younger brother Owen says an incredibly insightful thing to him. Can you recreate that for us?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, you know, Owen is speaking in what's called echolalia, or scripting, up to that point. And autistic parents will know what I'm talking about, where lots of kids on the spectrum memorize scripts or memorize language, though it's believed they don't really understand what those words mean. And there's some evidence that supports that. Echolalia, like echo, like a parrot.
Right.
But Owen seemed to be choosing phrases that had meaning. So we were going back and forth with the doctors. He said, you know, beauty lies within. We said, well, that's the key phrase of the movie, the one he's repeating. Maybe he knows what the movie's about. Well, we can't tell. Well, he's about 6 and a half. And he's not saying much. Cornelia, of course, is doing everything under the sun. I am too, but mostly her speech therapy, play therapy, occupational therapy. And he has just 2 or 3 word sentences at that point. Well, his brother, who is one of these, siblings of folks with disabilities often grow up very fast. And his brother at 9 is already a very tough, independent kid who can handle anything the world throws at him. Except on one day a year, sometimes he gets a little emotional, his birthday. Well, we don't much notice this, but on his 9th birthday, Walt gets a teeny bit emotional, and Owen follows us into the kitchen from the backyard. We're bringing the plates and the cups, and he says to me and Cornelia, he says rather intently, Walter doesn't want to grow up like mm-hmm. Mowgli or Peter Pan.
Wow.
And it was, Marty, it was like a thunderbolt went through the kitchen. We didn't know what was happening. Owen runs off in some private reverie, and Cornelia and I just start talking to each other. We can't stop talking for 4 hours, at which point she looks at me. Now, here's a woman who is, at this point, auditioning for sainthood. She is up every night with Owen. She's running around the clock. She was a journalist like I am, but stopped doing that once the diagnosis was offered for Owen. And she's like, look, you know, you're the kooky one. You're the guy who dresses a clown at the birthday parties and wears the propeller hat. Find a way back in there. You can do the voices. So I go up to Owen's bedroom that night, and I grab a puppet he is very into at that point, Iago. Now, for Disney folks, any
sure.
parents, actually.
Aladdin,
that would be,
right?
That's right. That's Jafar's evil sidekick, Gilbert Gottfried. And I grab the – and, oh, and of course, we have everything from Disney you can buy. I mean, literally, we're taking out a second mortgage to buy Disney junk. And I put the puppet – it's one of the big ones – up to my elbow. I crawl up to the side of his bed, push up the puppet. And so it's eye to eye with Owen. And I say to him in Gilbert Gottfried's voice – I say, Owen, how does it feel to be you, to be Owen? And he turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. And he says, not good. I'm lonely and I have no friends. Mm. And I just bite down hard and say, just stay in character. What would Iago say next? And I say, okay, when did you and I become friends? Such good friends. And Owen says, when I watched Aladdin and you made me laugh. And we start to talk. This is our first conversation since he's two and a half. And after a few minutes, I hear him clear his throat, you know, but he's only six and a half, so it's up here like that. And he says, I love the way your foul little mind works. Now, that's Jafar. Now, at this point, you know, I just jump up and start yelling, hugging him. And we realize that Owen has memorized the dialogue. So if you throw him a line, he'll throw you back the next line, and you better be ready with the follow-up line. He can go on for an hour like this. So we start playing out scenes, all four of us, Owen and his older brother, me and Cornelia, every scene we can find from 20 Disney animated movies. This becomes what we call the basement sessions, and it goes on for years. And what's interesting, Marty, is that Owen seems not just to be reciting. He seems to be selling the lines, as an actor would say, feeling the emotions. And that gives us hope that he understood what those characters were feeling. Again, not something he's supposed to be able to do.
But it sounds like Disney, I mean, perhaps he had several families, and one of them was your family, Ron, but the other were these family of characters.
Well, what happened is that we inhabited those characters with him. It was our way. And once Owen becomes an aficionado of sidekicks after he's whacked. He's thrown out of a school. He's quite bruised. He's about 11 years old. He really can't express his feelings. But all of a sudden, he becomes an expert on the sidekicks. There are hundreds of them in Disney. And what we realize is that Owen, at this point, sees the wider world. He realizes that he's caught in the starting blocks. Other kids are racing forward. And he feels like a sidekick himself, not a hero. And he becomes an expert on hundreds of them. You know, the sidekicks, some are goofy, some are wise, some are confused. And he starts to live through them. He draws furiously at this point, almost like an animator. He can draw almost like the animators now. And I find a sketchbook. And the last two things he writes, kind of in a kindergartner's scrawl, he's 11, is, I am the protector of the sidekicks. And the last thing he writes is, no sidekick gets left behind.
Mm.
And at that point, he starts in the cards for Mother's Day or Father's Day, he starts giving us sidekick identities. Now, Cornelia is often Big Mama from Fox and the Hound. She's the wisest and gentlest of the women sidekicks. I'm Merlin. I'm very happy with that, with Merlin from Sword of the Stone. And I can do the voice, you know. Knowledge and wisdom's the real power, my boy. And so Owen can do the voice, too. And we do that back and forth. He does Arthur, I do Merlin, then we switch. On some days, I'd be Rafiki. That was good, too.
From the Lion King, right?
The Lion King. You know, wrong again. He lives in you. And, of course, Owen does these voices with such power. I had to bring up my game in terms of imitations just to match him. Interestingly, though, the only person he draws as a hero is his brother. Only Walter is drawn as a hero for his birthdays and for Hanukkah and Christmas.
So
that was part of Owen speaking through what he turns into an emotional language. You know, interestingly though, at a dinner table when Owen's 14 and Walter's now 17, Owen is going on and on. Now he's well into his sidekicks philosophy and really making sense of the word through these sidekicks and himself. Is Walt challenges him. At one point, Owen's going on about the return of traditional hand-drawn animation, which, of course, he loves because he draws now like an animator. And he says, you know, to draw it, you got to feel it, and he can only feel as he draws. So, and Walt's like, look, Owen, they put out two computer animated movies a week now. The hand-drawn stuff, that's over. But listen, if you want it to come back, you got to step up. You got to lead the charge. Now, this is the first time Owen gets challenged. We don't challenge him this way, but especially his brother. The one who's drawn as a hero. He said, Owen, you got any movies in you? Any ideas? And Owen kind of sits there, kind of stunned. And after a few minutes, he kind of bubbles up. You see, he gets a kind of look where he's digging in, digging deep. And he says, well, I do have one idea. 12 sidekicks searching for a hero. And in their journey and in the obstacles they face, each finds the hero within themselves. And that ends up being really Owen's life narrative, searching for the inner hero. And here, mind you, Marty, Owen, like a lot of kids, now he is like so many kids. Owen has a measurable IQ of 75. All right, you know, to put an IQ score on so many untraditional learners or kids with challenges like Owen, there should be a statute against that. But the fact is, people see that score for so many kids like Owen and say, the discard pile. Here's a mop until you die, and make sure you're happy. That is a loss of possibility, not just for these kids, but for all of us, of not saying, look, they're not going to be like us. They're going to be like them. Have them be more like them. Figure out a way that affinity, that passion can, in a way, become a pathway. And that's what we found. It was more pathway than prison. And that was the view for many years. And still, that these affinities, these obsessions, almost every kid on the spectrum has some. It could be Thomas the Tank Engine. It could be Disney. It could be maps or train schedules. That they are a trap, a prison. We found they really were a vehicle. Once we got in deep with him and got in without a notion of we're going to pull him out of here and we're just here to figure out a way to drag him up to sunlight, we lived down there. And eventually he showed us all that was in his underground world.
You know, when we talk about someone's fascination with something, we talk about them being passionate about it. But if they have a diagnosis of autism or some kind of disability, then we call it an obsession, you know, somehow that it's less than a passion. And it seems that Owen was, yes, obsessed with Disney, but he had a deep passion for it, too.
It's so insightful, Marty. Look, to draw the line between passion and obsession, boy, that's a tricky line to draw.
Sure.
But because the specific challenge of these kids is they can't jump around. They're not generally interested in things as many people are. That's their specific malady, if you will. Of course, almost anything they fix on is going to be seemingly to the exclusion of everything else. And that's, I think, a bit of the blind spot we've had in the so-called neurotypical community, whatever that means, over many, many years. And I think what the book is doing and research that is emerging from the book is changing that. It's reversing the telescope. And right now, MIT and Yale, Cambridge University, Duke, and even folks at NIH are talking about looking at these affinities in a new way and understanding the mechanism that drives these intense, deep areas of focus. And the notion is this, and it's in the book in this way. We called it affinity therapy. Originally, we called it Disney therapy. But there are several and many affinities, probably 20 of them, that are the major affinities that a lot of these kids embrace in this period, whatever's out there now in the popular culture often, the affinity, if you focus on it, and they're thinking of now they're going to do fMRIs to see what mechanisms fire in the brains of these kids, it can lead you to understanding underlying capabilities that might be otherwise invisible that might then lead to better possibilities once they're harnessed in the lives of these kids, which is, of course, better for everyone.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
That was my interview with journalist and author Ron Suskind about his book Life Animated, which was made into a documentary. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.